One of my favorite historical characters, and probably unarguably one of the greatest historical characters of the 20th century, was Winston Churchill. And one of the things that I admired about Churchill was his very unique way that he used the English language. He could turn a phrase like nobody could. And he said things and said them in a way that were unforgettable. In 1939, as what would become known as World War II was beginning to heat up, Churchill was asked what he thought Russia might do. Would Russia get into the war? And in answering that question, here's what Churchill said about Russia. It's a riddle wrapped in a mystery, inside an enigma. But perhaps there is a key. Out of all the things Churchill said, that's one of the favorite quotes of mine, as he was describing how difficult it was to try to figure out what Russia might do. I don't want to talk about Russia or Churchill or World War II this morning, but I do want to take that phrase there that Churchill made and apply it to that book. Because a lot of times, when we get to the very last book of the New Testament, that's the way we sum it up. Somebody says, what is the Revelation all about? And somebody says, well, it's a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. And unfortunately, that's the way so many people think about it. It just not decipherable. You can't figure it out. Go back to Churchill's statement. He said, but there's a key. Or perhaps there is a key. And the same thing, I think, is true about the Revelation. Are there some things about the Revelation that are a riddle wrapped inside a mystery, inside an enigma? Yes. But are there keys that will help us to understand this last book of the Bible? And I believe that there are. There are some keys that will unlock for us the mysteries of Jesus' revelation to John. And I know that there have to be some keys that will help us to unravel this mystery because of something that is said in the very beginning of the Revelation. Jesus said, John wrote it, but Jesus said it, blessed is he who reads and those who hear the words of the prophecy and heed the things which are written in it, for the time is near. The word blessed there means happy. It's the same word that's used in the Beatitudes. Happy is he, notice the singular. This revelation was going to be read by an individual. Blessed is he who reads and those, notice the plural, he who reads and those who hear. The individual who read this revelation would be happy and those who heard what he read would be happy. Therefore, I know that there are bound to be ways to understand the revelation. There have to be some keys that help us to understand this because Jesus said and pronounced a blessing upon those who would hear the words of the prophecy of the book. Let me go through just, in fact, we're going to be taking a look at the next two or three Sunday mornings. We're going to be taking a look at some keys that unlock the mysteries of Jesus' revelation to John. Let me go through very quickly this morning what three of these are, and here's what we'll build our study around. One of them is the recognition of figurative language. Do not read the revelation and think in terms of the literal. There is a place called heaven, but there is not a street of gold in heaven. A literal street with literal gold. There is not in this place called heaven literal gates with literal jewels. Those things do not exist. Those are figurative terms to describe to us what heaven is like. We read in the Revelation about harpists playing upon their harps. And unfortunately, some have, in trying to justify instrumental music in assemblies, have said, well, there are harps in heaven. There are not any harps in heaven. Never have been, there aren't now, and there never will be. That's not the point. Harps are as figurative as the street, as the gold, as the jewels, as the gates. The robes that the redeemed are said to wear are not literal robes of cloth. All of these things, and then there's so, of course, so many other things in the Revelation which are figurative in nature. And we must realize that if we try to literalize these things, we are making a huge, huge mistake. There is a second thing, and perhaps this is one of the things that has been ignored through the years. And that is the Old Testament imagery that is found in the Revelation. I really believe that a person is not prepared adequately to study the Revelation until you've had several classes in the Old Testament. Because so much of the figurative language that we just spoke of, so much of that figurative language is taken from the Old Testament. And until and unless we understand the Old Testament background of that language, then we're not going to understand Jesus' use of it as He revealed this revelation to John. And been my experience in studying the Revelation through the years, I suggest to people, okay, let's start with the Old Testament. And they don't want to do that. They want to get into the beast and the dragons and all of that stuff. That is a huge mistake. And so as you study the Revelation, make sure that you're ready to do some flipping back and forth between the Revelation and the Old Testament, because it is in the Old Testament that you have one of the keys that will unlock some of the mysteries in this book. And then there is that which we want to talk about this morning. And that is, as you read through the Revelation, notice words and phrases that are repeated over and over and over again. Now, this is true in any piece of literature in the Bible. It is especially true in the Revelation. But whether you're reading Romans or you're reading the Revelation, if you will read it and look for words and ideas that are repeated over and over again, pretty soon the message of the Revelation will emerge and it will cease to be a mystery. I've said before, and I'll repeat it, the best commentary ever written on the Revelation was written by John on the Isle of Patmos. The Revelation is its own best commentary. And so this morning we're going to be focusing attention upon one particular idea, upon one particular word. And this is just one of many, many that are found in the Revelation that will help us to understand and appreciate this great message. And the one that we want to look at this morning is the throne of God. God's throne is one of the predominant themes in the Revelation. Now, once again, whenever you see that word throne, don't think of a big, high-backed, ornate piece of furniture, similar to the throne that we think of when we think of the Queen of England or others who are royalty and who sit upon ceremonial thrones. It's not the idea at all. The idea of the throne in the Revelation is the idea of rule and power and authority and dominion. Abstract ideas. And they are conveyed to us in terms of pieces of furniture and things of that nature. The word throne occurs 61 times in the New Testament. 46 of those times it occurs in the Revelation. 46 out of 61 times. The idea of that's twice per chapter in Revelation on an average. When you get to chapter 4 in the Revelation, the word throne occurs 13 times. So, what is chapter 4 in the Revelation all about? It's about the throne of God. And so as we look at the Revelation this morning, we're going to be taking a look at passages which talk about the throne of God, the rule of God, the power of God, the dominion of God, and God exercising that rule and power and dominion. And John describes it, because Jesus revealed it to him that way, in terms of a piece of furniture. But let's think in terms of rule and authority and dominion and power, and see what lessons are contained in the passages which contain the word throne. Let's start in chapter 4, verses 1 and 2. After these things I looked, and behold, and that word behold is significant. That directs your attention to something. And behold, a door, again, not literal, but access. A door standing open in heaven. And the first voice which I heard, like the sound of a trumpet, speaking with me, said, "Come up here, and I will show you what must take place after these things." Immediately, I was in the Spirit, and behold, a throne was standing in heaven, and one sitting on the throne. Now, at the risk of overemphasizing this, we're not talking about, and we shouldn't think about, God seated on a piece of furniture. When John says he saw a throne, he's saying that he saw that there was a rule and a reign existing in heaven. Someone in heaven is ruling. Someone in heaven is reigning. And that's one of the lessons that you learn from these verses. The place of the throne in Revelation is heaven. The ultimate rule, the ultimate power, the ultimate authority anywhere is located in heaven. Jesus says, or John saying what Jesus told him, John says it was standing in heaven. The word standing there refers to permanence, rigidity, something that is like a fence post that is put into the ground very deeply, or a pillar that you're going to use to construct a building. It's deep, deep in the ground, and it's firm and it's unshakable. The throne of God, the rule of God, is permanent. There is nothing that can shake it. This is what I'm convinced that Daniel had in mind in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 44. When he said, talking about this vision that he had, or that Nebuchadnezzar had, that he was interpreting, and he told Nebuchadnezzar that that fourth kingdom, in the days of those kings, which was the Roman Empire, the God of heaven will establish a kingdom. And he's not talking there about the establishment of the church. And we've used that verse that way, and that's not what he's talking about. When Daniel says in Daniel 2:44 that in the days of those kings, God will set up a kingdom, he's essentially saying God will set up a throne. He will set up a rule. He will set up His power and authority in Jesus Christ. And that throne will never be destroyed. That kingdom, that rule will never be destroyed. On this earth, it's taking place now, and it's been taking place in all of human history. And Daniel, you see this in the book of Daniel. You have kingdoms rise and kingdoms fall. And another kingdom will arise, another kingdom will fall. Rule is exercised by this nation, and then they lose it, and another nation rules, and then they lose it. And one of these days, the rule that is characterized by the United States of America will be lost. If time goes on. Doesn't take a genius to figure that out. That's simply the way history goes. But there is a rule. There is a power and authority, and there is a dominion which will never be shaken. Hebrews 12, verses 23 and 24, along with Daniel 2 and verse 44. And that rule is permanent, and it's being exercised by God, and it's in heaven. And we need to be thankful for that. John looked again. Verses 3 and 4. And he who was sitting, that is, God exercising His rule. He who was sitting was like a jasper stone and a sardius in appearance. And there was a rainbow around the throne, like an emerald in appearance. Around the throne were 24 thrones. And upon the thrones I saw 24 elders, sitting, clothed in white garments and golden crowns on their heads. Now, a lot of that language is difficult to understand. It's that mystery and silent enigma and so forth. But the general idea, the language here of the jewels and the rainbow, is simply saying what I said a moment ago. That the rule of God is ultimate. There is not a rule upon this earth, and there is not a rule in the heavens that is superior to this rule. There are kingdoms that rule and exercise dominion on this earth. And there is someone else who is exercising rule in heaven along with God. You know who that is? It's the devil. He is exercising a degree of rule and authority and dominion. But it is not like God's throne, God's rule, God's dominion. One of these days, God will bring an end to all earthly rule. There will not be anything on this earth. There will be no nation upon this earth. In fact, there won't be an earth. It will all be burned up. At that time, the rule of the devil, his authority and his power that he exercises through his agents, through his angels, through demons and so forth, that will come to an end. And all people will see the throne of God. That the rule of God is the ultimate. There is not anything that can surpass it, that can take its place. John says something very comforting about the rule of God. Another angel came, chapter 8. Another angel came and stood at the altar, holding a golden censer, and much incense was given to him. so that he might add it to the prayers of all the saints on the golden altar, which was before the throne. And the smoke of the incense with the prayers of the saints went up before God out of the angel's hand. Have you ever wanted to write a letter or today write an email to somebody in Washington, but you thought, what good is it going to do? Nobody is going to listen. That's right. You can email, write all letters you want to. And if you get a response, it's going to be, I got several times when I wrote people up there expressing my concerns, I got a form letter that did not even begin to address my problem, my question, my concern. They're not listening. They don't hear. And political opinion right here, they don't care. Okay, enough of political opinion. God's throne is aware of what is going on in my life. These verses teach me that I can talk to the throne. I can address myself to God, who is exercising the ultimate rule and power and authority. And not only will God listen, He will do what? Not only will He hear, He will do what? He will act in regard to what I talk to Him about. He'll do something about it. Now, He may not do what I want done. He may not act in the timely manner in which I wish He would, but God responds to prayer. And these verses here, which talk about the prayers of the saints, which go up before the throne, before God who exercises rule, He is aware. And our prayers are, as it were, very fine-smelling incense. And God answers prayer. And I think this needs to be talked about. I said something in the Bible class this morning that I was teaching about some things I hear, some things I read. Well, you've got some people who are teaching, in essence, that God does not hear prayer. That it doesn't do any good to pray for the sick. It doesn't do any good to pray. I don't know why they think we're told to pray. Let me suggest to you, these verses in the Revelation tell me why I should pray. Because God exercises the ultimate power and rule in the universe, and He not only listens to and hears our prayers, but He acts in regard to them. In chapter 19, looking at the throne of God, God's rule from another aspect, and the 24 elders and the four living creatures fell down and worshipped God who sits on the throne, saying, Amen, Hallelujah, which means praise Jehovah. And a voice came from the throne saying, Give praise to our God, all you His bondservants, you who fear Him, the small and the great. Whenever we assemble on occasions like this, whenever we pray, whenever we sing, whenever we engage in what we would call worship, and obviously worship is not confined to a building such as this. Well, let's just use this as an example. That when we sing and pray, that worship is being directed toward the rule and the authority and the dominion of God. Toward the one who sits, as it were, on the throne, who exercises that. Now, if there was really the awareness of that there should be, would that make a difference in our worship? For instance, and I've got no problem with having singing training and singing schools. We've had them here, and they've been good ones, and we'll probably have more. I think we probably should. I'm all in favor of that. But let me suggest to you that the thing that will best improve our singing, you know what it is an awareness that those words that are being uttered are being directed toward the throne of God. Would that take care of singing, "Oh, how I love Jesus," like that? Or would we not sing that song realizing that what we're saying is being directed toward the throne of God? Now, we might need some help in regard to singing, in regard to the mechanics and music and so forth, but as far as the spirit of our singing, that can be taken care of simply by reading verses like this, that worship is directed toward the throne of God. And that takes care of the passion and the spirit and the emotion that should characterize the things that we say and do. Chapter 5, verse 1. As chapter 4 is about the throne, chapter 5 is about a book. Chapter 5 and verse 1, I saw in the right hand of Him who sat on the throne. And again, the right hand is not literal. A book written inside and on the back, sealed up with seven seals. That is simply talking about God's revelation to mankind. That's just a figurative way, because there is no literal book up there in heaven. No literal scroll that you... But as it were, God's revelation is contained in a scroll. And I get from this verse that revelation concerning spiritual things comes only from heaven. It doesn't come from the Vatican. It doesn't come from Salt Lake City. It doesn't come from anywhere else. Revelation concerning the will of God comes from heaven. And it was completed some 2,000 years ago. And we need nothing today to be added to it. And anything that is added to it today is too much. And it's too late. Out from the throne came flashes of lightning and sounds and peals of thunder. And there were seven lamps of fire burning before the throne, which are the seven spirits of God. Then I saw a great white throne, and Him who sat upon it, from whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. Judgment comes from the throne. I don't take these verses to mean just ultimate judgment, which will take place at the end of time, but God is in the process now of judging things upon the earth. The rise and the fall of kingdoms, the things that happen to nations today. I'm convinced, because of what we read about in the Old Testament especially, God is causing those things to happen. And when nations fall, and when nations suffer things that are calamitous in nature, that's God's judgment many times. That's God causing it. And then obviously at the end of time, judgment is going to come. And it's going to come from God, whose rule and reign and authority in heaven are ultimate. Punishment comes from the throne of God. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the presence of Him who sits on the throne. And from the wrath of the Lamb." The Lamb here is Jesus, of course. We think of Jesus as being so sweet and gentle and tender. And there is an aspect of Him. But notice here, the wrath of the Lamb. "For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" Then the seventh angel poured out his bowl upon the air, and a loud voice came out of the temple from the throne, saying, "It is done." At the throne of God, we find the answer to our prayers. At the throne of God, we find grace and mercy and peace. That same throne punishes and is vindictive toward those who ignore His will. But this throne is the source of ultimate victory. After these things I looked, and behold, a great multitude, which no one could count, from every nation and all tribes and peoples and tongues, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, clothed in white robes, and palm branches were in their hands. And they cry out with a loud voice, saying, "Salvation to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb." There's coming a day when we'll gain victory over death. There'll be no more death. Victory over sickness. Victory over all the trials of this life. And that victory is going to come from the throne of God. Finally, one last look at the throne of God. "And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which are written in the books according to their deeds." Do we need to be reminded that one day we'll stand before the God who exercises ultimate rule and power and authority? And we're going to be judged at that time by that God in the presence of that throne. If that's true, and I believe that it is, if it's true that someday I must stand before God's throne and be judged, and because I don't know when my death might come, doesn't it make sense to make preparations now, today, this morning, while you have the time and while you have the opportunity? Make your preparations now to stand before the throne of God so that heaven can be your home for eternity. Can we encourage you in that? Let's stand and sing.
Careless soul, why will you linger? Your sad condition.
God.